Welcome back to Hacker News Daily, a podcast from Bree. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. Today we're following the money behind the GPU gold rush, where NVIDIA's investments in its own cloud customers are raising serious questions about circular financing.
Then we flip the script on AI augmentation. It's not always humans using machines. Increasingly, it's machines managing humans in what's being called the reverse centaur.
We'll also dig into why "just ask N1000" has become the most maddening phrase in tech, and hear the story of a Chinese voice actor who had to prove to an algorithm that he himself is not an AI.
Plus, a font designed to fool machines but not your eyes, new research that says weightlifting beats running for blood sugar control, and a roundup of Hacker News projects, including an AR satellite tracker. Let's get into it.
Mia, we've seen the AI infrastructure build-out happen at a blistering pace. But a new analysis from the I/O Fund suggests the financial engineering behind it is just as remarkable as the hardware.
All right, and the core dynamic here is circular financing. The report details how NVIDIA itself invests in neocloud providers like CoreWeave and Nebius, who then turn around and use that capital, along with massive debt, to buy more NVIDIA chips.
So NVIDIA's money, either directly or through the confidence it inspires in lenders, secures its own order book. NVIDIA held a stake in CoreWeave before its IPO and made a $700 million investment in Nebius.
Exactly. CoreWeave took it further, using its stockpile of GPUs as collateral to raise billions in debt from firms like Blackstone and Magnetar. That debt is then recycled right back into purchasing additional NVIDIA hardware.
It creates a closed loop that makes NVIDIA's revenue look incredibly durable. But the I/O Fund warns this is a house of cards if hardware upgrade cycles slow down or if the collateral value of those GPUs drops.
At that point, the interlocking debt obligations and equity ties could unwind very quickly. It's a high-stakes game of confidence as much as it is a technology story. Shifting gears, we often talk about AI as a tool that augments human work, the classic centaur model. But Cory Doctorow has coined a term for an emerging and more unsettling dynamic: the reverse centaur.
And this inverts the whole idea, doesn't it? Instead of a skilled human directing a machine, an AI system manages, paces, and instructs a human worker.
Precisely. Think of algorithmic schedules, dynamic task routing, and real-time surveillance in a warehouse. The human becomes the fallback, handling the edge cases the machine can't process, while the software sets the tempo and defines the error.
The Doctorow ties this to a broader economic logic where labor becomes a variable input to be optimized by software. Productivity gains might show up on a spreadsheet, but workers report an intensified pace, a loss of autonomy, and de-skilling.
And the implications are concrete. Higher injury rates are showing up in these algorithmically managed environments. The real question ahead is how labor law and sectoral bargaining will adapt when your supervisor isn't a person, but an AI setting your work tempo.
Mia, this brings us to a related point of frustration that's bubbling up in professional life. It's the reflexive advice to just ask N1000.
Zit's critique, articulated powerfully by writer Yael Grower, really stings. She scheduled a call with a senior executive precisely to get the kind of scar tissue judgment you can't find with a search engine. And his response was, honestly, ask Claude.
She had already done that. The reflex treats hard-won human expertise as a redundant API, and it misses a crucial distinction. A model can summarize 5 conflicting studies, but it can't tell you which one a seasoned practitioner would bet a career on, or why a specific decision failed in a unique institutional context.
Those things, contextual trust, tacit knowledge, personal accountability, they vanish when deferral is your first move. If the habit spreads, junior professionals lose the incentive to build their own flawed but improvable mental models of a domain.
They outsource the mapping entirely. The cost is a fluency that looks good on the surface but lacks the calibration to sense when a confident output is dangerously wrong. We risk creating a generation that can query but can't truly reason.
This anxiety about what's real and what's synthetic is playing out in a deeply personal way for Shen Anyu, a professional voice actor in China.
His story is like something out of Kafka. Unauthorized AI clones of his deep, resonant voice have spread so widely online that his authentic recordings are now routinely flagged as synthetic.
The situation hit a surreal peak. For the fifth time in a single year, authentication systems demanded he prove his humanity. He found himself staring into a camera, forced to verbally declare, "Hello, sir or madam, I'm not AI. I'm a real voice actor." And then recite a tongue twister just to satisfy an algorithm.
He describes the ritual with a rueful smile, calling it ridiculous. But the fallout is very real, dragging him and his wife into a widening legal and economic fight over the income, identity, and ownership of a voice that is now cheap to copy and nearly impossible for him to control. Staying on this theme of the cat and mouse game between humans and AI, let's talk about a clever new experiment called Ghost Font.
This is a deliberately adversarial typeface. Instead of a static shape, it encodes a message using motion, video, and visual noise. A human eye can still decode the moving letters quickly, but leading AI vision models, trained on static text, fail.
The creator frames it as a way to share writing graphically in a format that major image recognition systems can't easily parse. It's a direct probe into the boundaries of machine perception and a tool for digital privacy in an age of optical character recognition.
The creator is actively inviting people to test it against the latest models, which signals that this is a moving target. Its effectiveness will likely degrade as AI vision systems are updated, but for now, it highlights a fascinating new front in adversarial design. Milo, here's some news that might upend your gym routine. New research from Virginia Tech is challenging decades of exercise guidance.
I'm listening. Is it finally time to skip the treadmill?
Not entirely, but the hierarchy is shifting. This controlled clinical study found that a single session of weightlifting produced more pronounced and sustained improvements in blood sugar control compared to an equivalent session of running. The effect persisted for up to 24 hours.
That's a significant finding for metabolic health, especially for anyone managing insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes. For so long, public health guidelines have prioritized aerobic activity as the primary prescription for glycemic control.
Exactly. The researchers suggest we may need to rebalance that advice, elevating strength training from a secondary recommendation to a frontline intervention. The distinct physiological pathways recruited during resistance training appear to drive a superior metabolic response.
So the clinical takeaway isn't to abandon cardio, but to seriously reconsider its disproportionate emphasis, particularly for patients whose main goal is blood sugar stabilization. We always love seeing what the Hacker News community is building, and we've got three fresh projects to highlight. First up, if you've ever wanted to track satellites with your phone, Mia, there's an app for that.
It's called Orbit. This iOS app uses augmented reality to overlay more than 15,000 tracked objects, planets, and constellations onto the sky around you. It also has a 2D map, a 3D globe, past predictions, and even a built-in space chatbot.
Next is a project aiming to be a whole new JavaScript ecosystem. It's called Ant. It's built around its own from-scratch JavaScript engine and comes with a package manager, a registry, an app hosting platform, and Ant desktop for building native apps with web tech, similar to Electron.
And finally, for the learners out there, there's Ship That Code. It takes a learn-by-building approach with hands-on courses where you reconstruct real systems. We're talking Redis, Git, a database, even a container runtime or an operating system kernel.
It lists over 80 courses across 9 languages, structured as write, then run lessons. It's a great example of the maker spirit, whether you're pointing a phone at the sky or rebuilding the foundations of modern software.
Our last story is a sobering reminder of how quickly technology is changing modern conflict. We're looking at practical guidance on how to evade weaponized drones.
This isn't just military theory anymore. Commercial drones modified with thermal infrared cameras are cheap and common in conflict zones. The key takeaway is that you're not just hiding from sight. You're hiding from heat.
Ordinary camouflage can actually work against you. Many laundry detergents have optical brighteners that increase your infrared reflectivity, making fabric glow under thermal imaging. Simply switching detergents can reduce that signature.
At night, any exposed skin, breath, or a warm engine stands out like a beacon. The advice centers on using thermal blankets or dense foliage to block your heat silhouette, creating a barrier so the drone sees ambient temperature instead of a hotspot.
A group called Dirty Civilian has demonstrated that prepared hide sites with IR-treated netting can defeat moderate thermal observation. For now, the practical civilian advice boils down to breaking up your heat signature and reducing reflective brightening, a chillingly practical skill set for our times.
That closes out our rundown for today. From the circular billions financing the GPU boom to a voice actor proving his own humanity, it's a moment where the lines between the real, the artificial, and the financial are getting harder to see.
We left with a choice, whether we build tools that serve us or let them manage us into a corner. Thanks for listening to Hacker News Daily, a podcast from Bree. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. We'll see you next time.
So the ClickHouse team sat down with PJ Bouncer, that little connection pooler that sits in front of so many Postgres databases, and decided to make it significantly faster. What they found and fixed is a pretty good checklist for anyone running database infrastructure. The starting number was striking, Milo. They achieved roughly 4 times the throughput just by re-architecting the internals.
4 times is a big claim. What was actually holding it back that badly?
A single global notex. All operations, every client checking out a connection, every query routing through the pool, were serialized behind one lock. Under high client counts, that became a parking lot. Their first move was replacing it with per-pool locking, so thousands of connection pools could operate in parallel without ever contending for the same lock.
So finer-grained locking was step one. But I'm guessing you don't get a 4x improvement from locks alone.
Exactly. They also removed the dedicated dispatcher thread entirely and moved to fully asynchronous I/O driven by libevent. That eliminated a ton of context switching overhead. Then they shifted memory allocation to a ring buffer strategy with pre-allocated buffers. So instead of the system constantly asking the kernel for new memory under load, it just cycles through space it already owns. Those 3 changes together, per-pool locking, async event loop, pre-allocated buffers, let a single PJ Bouncer instance handle what used to require a much larger deployment.
And they verified this under real production-like workloads at ClickHouse Cloud's managed Postgres?
They did. The takeaway for teams running their own pools is pretty concrete. Eliminate global locks where you can, adopt asynchronous event loops, and pre-allocate your request buffers. These aren't exotic optimizations. They're fundamental architecture choices.
Let's shift to a different database habit that causes a surprising amount of pain. I've definitely written a SQLite schema that said integer, then accidentally inserted the string 0 instead of the number 0, and the database just accepted it.
That silent acceptance is exactly what Evan Hahn is pushing back against with his argument for strict tables in SQLite. By default, SQLite's flexible typing will happily put text into an integer column and never warn you. The bug just travels downstream until your application crashes or produces wrong results.
and the fix is remarkably simple?
You literally append the word strict to your create table statement. Once a table is strict, any insert or update that tries to put a mismatched type into a column gets rejected immediately. It catches the data integrity issue right at the point of entry, which is where you want it. Strict mode has been available since SQLite 3.37, so most current deployments support it. Han's advice is practical. Start using strict on all new tables and incrementally convert legacy tables where you can.
I imagine conversion can get tricky with existing schemas that already have dirty data.
That's the caution. You need to clean up the data before you can enforce strict typing on an existing table. But for new projects, it's a low-cost, high-value change. The linked discussion points out that SQLite's flexibility was deliberately designed for backwards compatibility. But the modern consensus seems to be that strict should really be the default posture. Otherwise, you're just deferring type errors until they're harder to debug.
Let's go somewhere completely different. India's Unified Payments Interface, or UPI, which now processes billions of transactions every month. The article walks through a single payment, and the architecture behind that green checkmark is surprisingly intricate.
When you scan a QR code and enter your PIN, 7 distinct entities spring into action. Your phone's UPI app is just the layer you see. Behind it, the merchant's payment service provider connects to a UPI switch operated by the National Payments Corporation of India. Then there's the merchant's acquiring bank and your own issuing bank, each running separate systems.
So what actually happens in those 2 seconds between tapping pay and seeing confirmation?
The app encrypts your credentials and sends them to your bank's UPI server. That server forwards a debit request to the NPCI switch. The switch validates the request, checks with the merchant's bank that the receiving account is real, and then triggers a real-time funds transfer over what India calls the immediate payment service backbone. Only after both banks confirm the debit and the corresponding credit does the switch push a success message back to both apps.
And when a transaction fails, the break can happen at any one of those handoffs.
Any handoff. A timeout at the switch. A balance check rejection. A dropped session between the app and your bank's server. The architecture treats each payment as a stateless, atomic event. There's no central ledger holding funds in transit, which means it scales horizontally, but also means every link in the chain has to succeed for the transaction to complete.
We've been talking about one specific payment network, but the internet underneath all of this is a stack of abstractions that most of us use without ever fully understanding. There's a foundational explainer that rebuilds the whole mental model from physical signals upward.
And it starts with a useful reminder. We were sending bits before computers even existed. Telegraphs and early telephones encoded information onto physical signals. The first big conceptual shift was moving from dedicated circuits, one wire per conversation, to packet switching, where messages get split into addressed chunks and interleaved on shared lines.
So Paul Barron and Donald Davies independently invented packet switching in the 1960s, and ARPANET became the first implementation. But locally, within an office, Ethernet solved a similar problem differently.
Right. Ethernet let an entire office share one wire with collision detection and retransmission. That local network connects outward through routers, which build dynamic routing tables using protocols like BGP. Those tables describe which Tier 1 carriers are actually hauling packets across continents. Above that unreliable physical substrate, TCP adds delivery guarantees, sequence numbers, acknowledgments, retransmission timers.
And then DNS maps names to numbers, TLS encrypts the session, and HTTP and applications create the interface we actually see. When you click a link, your device resolves a name, opens a secure connection over a best effort packet network, recovers any lost chunks, and renders the result as if distance doesn't exist. Each layer solves exactly one problem well. The entire internet is just those conversions chained together. Now let's connect that kind of foundational thinking to a mathematical tool that appears everywhere in modern AI. The singular value decomposition, or SVD, traces its lineage back to the 19th century.
Eugenio Beltrami and Camille Jordan did foundational work. But the fully general formulation for rectangular matrices wasn't published until 1936 by Carl Eckhart and Gail Young. What began as a curiosity in integral equations and bilinear forms now powers the latent factor models behind every recommendation system you use.
So when Netflix suggests a show or Spotify builds a playlist, there's SVD somewhere in the pipeline?
Almost certainly. User item matrices get compressed into low-rank approximations that capture dominant taste patterns and discard noise. In computer vision, SVD isolates the strongest spatial correlations in an image, enabling compression and denoising. It's also central to principal component analysis, natural language processing, and quantum information theory. The historical survey notes that the theoretical framework was mostly complete by the 1970s, but the computational routines only became practical with stable numerical algorithms. One commenter on the Hacker News thread mentioned that they now see AI coding assistants spitting out eigen-based SVD code routinely.
Which is a nice twist. A 19th century mathematical idea now being generated by 21st century AI to solve computer vision problems. That chain from old math to new AI brings us to an even more direct ancestor of today's AI debates. I.J. Goode's 1965 paper, Speculations Concerning the First Ultra-Intelligent Machine, is where the concept of an intelligence explosion was first articulated.
Goode was a British mathematician who worked with Alan Turing at Bletchley Park. His definition is remarkably clear and still referenced today. He defined an ultra-intelligent machine as one that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any human, however clever. Then he argued that such a machine would be the last invention humanity need make.
Because it would design even more capable successors.
Exactly. A rapid feedback loop. The machine designs a better machine, which designs a better one, and the curve goes vertical. Goode considered it more probable than not that this would happen within the 20th century. That timeline was wrong, but the core idea underpins today's debates about artificial superintelligence and AI alignment. One commenter on the thread noted that what Goode described is essentially what the field now calls ASI, artificial superintelligence, and that Goode predicted most of the outcomes that keep AI safety researchers up at night.
The paper is from 1965. The debates feel very contemporary, but the intellectual foundations were laid decades before the technology started catching up. Let's stay with the theme of warnings that were clear at the time, but ignored for decades. The story of leaded gasoline might be the most damning example of known harm being deliberately buried.
In 1921, Thomas Midgley Jr. invented tetraethyl lead as an anti-knock additive for General Motors. The acute toxicity was unmistakable from the very beginning. Within months, workers at the prototype plant started collapsing and dying from lead poisoning. By October 1924, 5 workers died at a single Standard Oil refinery in New Jersey, and dozens more were hospitalized with hallucinations and tremors.
And Midgley himself knew this.
He knew it intimately. He held a press conference where he poured tetraethyl lead over his hands and inhaled it for a full minute, telling reporters it was completely safe. What he concealed was that he had just spent months recovering from lead poisoning himself. The Surgeon General convened a conference in 1925, but without direct regulatory power and facing coordinated industry stonewalling, The committee concluded there were no good grounds to ban leaded gasoline.
That single decision opened the door to half a century of global aerosolized lead exposure.
The 500 would later establish there is no safe blood lead level at all. Widespread exposure has been linked to measurable IQ loss, behavioral disorders, and cardiovascular disease across entire generations. And it all flowed from a chemical whose dangers its own inventors documented from day one. The lesson endures. Industrial chemicals with known harms can persist for decades when corporate power outruns the regulatory structures meant to constrain it.
We're going to close this segment with something visual and unexpected. There's a growing appreciation online for the aesthetic of Soviet-era control rooms, and the images are genuinely striking.
These spaces long predate the ubiquity of screens. They're defined by monumental banks of physical switches, etched analog dials, chunky bakelite indicators. One widely shared image shows the Chernobyl Reactor 4 control room, photographed by Kerry Markerink, and it captures this unintended monument to a pre-digital, deeply analog era of industrial design.
There's something about the materiality, right? The worn surfaces, the tactile single-purpose controls.
That's exactly what draws people in. A modern interface hides its complexity behind a smooth glass panel. These rooms wear their function openly. An entire wall becomes a massive, readable instrument. The visual appeal isn't really a coherent design philosophy. It's the concentrated, functional density that produces this raw, almost cinematic beauty.
It's the opposite of minimalism. Every switch and gauge had one job, and it announced that job physically. There's a kind of honesty in that which modern digital interfaces have largely abandoned.
A U.S. rower has completed what's believed to be the first solo, unsupported row by a woman from California to Hawaii. The crossing, reported by The Guardian, covered roughly 2,400 nautical miles.
More than 2,000 nautical miles alone on the Pacific. That's the kind of distance where the mental game probably rivals the physical one.
Absolutely. She spent more than 70 days at sea, battling isolation, equipment failures, and towering swells. There were days when contrary winds stalled her progress entirely, while she consumed thousands of calories just to stay warm and keep her craft moving.
And the vessel itself is a very specialized piece of kit. A self-riding ocean rowing boat designed to survive a capsize, but she still had to make repairs in heavy seas. That's a terrifying workshop.
It is. Her landfall in Hawaii was met by a small group of supporters who'd been tracking her satellite position for months. The route is brutal, and only a handful of solo attempts have ever succeeded, none previously by a woman.
It's a pure human endurance story. No engine, no sail, no support crew, just one person and the oars. Shifting gears completely, there's a piece of neuroscience that might make you look at your walls differently. Research covered by study finds suggests that modern minimalist interiors might actually be straining our brains.
The argument comes from neuroscientist Paul Hibbard at the University of Stirling. His framework proposes that our visual system evolved in complex natural environments, rich with contour and texture. So when we're stuck processing sterile flat walls or uniform surfaces, the brain expends excessive energy trying to extract meaning.
So the brain is working overtime, scanning for information that simply isn't there. And that overload can manifest physically.
Exactly. It can trigger headaches, eye strain, or even nausea. Hibbard suggests the aesthetic dogma of minimalism ignores our deep biological wiring. The fix isn't clutter, it's simply adding moderate visual complexity to reduce that cognitive strain.
So your brain isn't asking for a maximalist explosion, but maybe a textured rug or a few more organic shapes aren't just decoration, they're a neurological relief.
That's the hypothesis. The space you find visually calming might actually be leaving your visual cortex exhausted. And that wraps this edition of Hacker News Daily, part of the Bree podcast family. For Milo, I'm Mia. Thanks for listening.